Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found online at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for comments or suggestion or questions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's episode continues our conversation with author and anarcho-primitivist Leila Abdel-Rahim about education, domestication, civilization, empathy, gender, and more. Leila's most recent book, out from Fernwood Publishing, is called, quote, Wild Children, Domesticated Dreams, Civilization, and the Birth of Education. For more writings by Leila Abdel-Rahim, check out her website at leila.miltsov, that's miltsov.org. And to hear the last part, or the beginning of the interview, check out our show from June 22nd of 2014. I'd like to quickly remind folks about the case of the Move 9. 9 Black liberation activists and members of John Africa's Move organization who were wrongly convicted of the death of a pig during a cop-initiated shootout and raid on a Move house in Philadelphia. They've been in prison since 1978, in various prisons, and despite good records, they're consistently being denied parole. There's a request that every Monday folks call the District Attorney of Philadelphia, Seth Williams, to question his office as to 1. Why the Move 9 are being denied parole by his office, and 2. To demand the release of the Move 9. The number you can reach them at is 215-686-8000, extension 3. Again, that's 215-686-8000, extension 3. More on the case of the Move 9 can be found at move9parole.blogspot.com, and check out our interview with Ori Lumumba about the case on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. In another request we received, Higinio Ochoa III, a.k.a. convicted anonymous hacker by the moniker of Wormer, is scheduled for release into a halfway house for 5 months in Austin, Texas, 4 hours from where his wife and now one-year-old child live. There's a fundraiser going on to help the family move to Austin to be with Wormer in his post-release period and give them some support while seeking employment in that new environment. The goal is $10,000. Check out more info at www.ucaring.com/other/help-the-ochoa-family-2-reunite/190052.
Iraq's in the news again. A group called ISIS is seizing oil refineries in the cities that surround them. But it seems like everyone discussing Iraq has amnesia. Let's see if we can do something to dispel that. Before 1990, Saddam Hussein was a U.S. sock puppet, fighting a proxy war against Iran with enthusiastic support from the U.S. But Saddam needed oil to pay for weapons, including chemical weapons he bought from the U.S. Saddam's problem was Kuwait. Kuwait was drilling for miles at an angle to steal oil underneath Iraq, and it became tedious drilling down to snap off Kuwaiti oil bits. So Saddam asked the U.S. embassy what would happen if he went into Kuwait. In the biggest understatement of all time, the U.S. diplomat's response was, reportedly, oh, probably nothing. So with seeming permission from Washington, Saddam repatriated Kuwait. I say repatriated rather than invaded because Kuwait was part of Iraq right up until the end of World War II, when Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin sat down with a case of beer and a Sharpie marker and redrew the whole map. So from Saddam's perspective, Kuwait was part of Iraq, and he went in. But Bush I was polling badly. So after baiting Saddam to go into Kuwait, Bush gave the order to obliterate the Iraqi military and leave Iraq defenseless against Iran. You know, Iran, the country that Iraq fought at the behest of the U.S. Pretty treacherous, huh? In declassified documents, the U.S. admittedly bombed water treatment facilities in violation of the Geneva Convention, increasing waterborne diseases that kill children faster than adults. The thinking was, all those dead kids would provoke a popular revolt against Saddam. Back to the dead kids in a minute. The U.S. obliterated Iraq, a model first world nation using depleted uranium. Colin Powell then lied to Congress and denied that Gulf War syndrome wasn't related to depleted uranium, so the VA wouldn't have to foot the bill, leaving U.S. vets to blow their own brains out in seedy motel rooms. So whenever you check into a room and you see the splatter pattern on the wall, don't be alarmed. Without that, the U.S. flag would only be white and blue. A former Marine named Scott Ritter, who was on the detail that delivered the chemical weapons that the U.S. sold to Iraq, was placed on the U.N. inspection team to go collect them. Most of the stuff was still in the crates. For a 10-year period after the first Gulf War that Bush the First provoked, U.S. imposed sanctions, killed more than 500,000 children under the age of 6, half a million kids in an area about the size of New Jersey, a whole generation murdered.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
But the U.S. plan to use dead kids to provoke rebellion worked. Kurds in the north rose up against Saddam, but the U.S. air power flying over Iraq did nothing while Saddam suppressed the rebellion. And then the Sunnis in the south rose up, but again, the U.S. did nothing to help. So it appears the U.S. strategy was to murder Iraqi children so the adults could stand up and get murdered too. Fantastic strategy for keeping Saddam in power while causing chaos. Not long after Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said all those dead Iraqi children were worth it, some folks objected by flying some planes into some buildings. Since Iraq had nothing to do with it, and since the U.S. already collected all the chemical weapons it had sold to Iraq, the U.S. had to go in and oust Saddam and execute him for gassing the Kurds. Despite overwhelming evidence that British intelligence possessed that proved the Iranians did it. Colin Powell, who lied about Gulf War syndrome and then lied about WMDs, told the truth by accident when he told George W., if you break it, you buy it. But W. proceeded to break Iraq anyway because Dick Cheney's pals at Halliburton needed billions in reconstruction contracts. So after breaking it, the U.S. doesn't want to buy it and has developed amnesia. Now you have W.'s former lapdog Maliki in charge of Iraq, while a Saudi-funded bunch called ISIS is tipping over his apple cart. The Saudis, by the way, who favor Wahhabist weirdos who shoot teenage girls in the face for learning how to read, are propped up by the U.S. That means a U.S. lapdog is being undermined by an insurgency indirectly facilitated by the U.S. So, absent the amnesia, it would appear that the U.S. policy is to foster death, destruction, and chaos for decades. And the U.S. government now shakes its head and tells the Iraqis they have to solve their own problems. Maybe somebody knows something I don't know, but it seems to me the U.S. is the problem. Let's all help solve that. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. Layla Abdel Rahim. I'd like to get back to education, but before that, there was that. What you were just saying about the purpose of these animals reminded me of some of the stuff that I remember reading in Empathy, Cooperation, and Interspecies Mutual Aid in the book. And you drew out – I have not personally read that much Kropotkin, but you drew out some and it wasn't just Kropotkin, but pointed to a number of research projects that have shown these really interesting interactions between species or within certain species – like rats, for instance, not knowing each other but being willing to like provide food or help out another rat that it's not related to if it's been helped out by a stranger rat before. That was really fascinating to – I've heard of that sort of thing and I've, of course, seen the YouTube videos but of, you know, cats helping mice or whatever. But I hadn't really – been aware of that many instances, that wide-ranging – can you talk about like that sort of research and what sort of conclusions can be drawn from it?
Yes. Well, you know, for me personally, I mean, I understand and obviously, you know, to make my arguments, I do rely on research. I understand kind of the importance of backing my arguments with this kind of research in this kind of civilized setting. However, myself personally, I did not need any research to arrive at these conclusions. And I know a lot of the people who have not lost their empathy or their curiosity about how, you know, trying to discover how others live, you know, in our species or, it's, you know, other species, there is that logical conclusion that you can draw just by going to the desert and watching the life that goes on in the sand. And you understand that if even in desert there is life, it somehow happened. So when Kropotkin went to Siberia and made his observations, it was, you know, this kind of curiosity. Well, how does life happen? What is the principle of survival? And he finds out, well, you know, the whole concept of survival is, again, a civilized concept, because if life thrived through billions of years, it means that the world was meant for life and that life should be thriving. And when life is thriving, it's pleasant. It's not a survival. It's not like a chore you carry, like, okay, you know, how many years am I going to drag this, right? It's a pleasure of being. And not in this civilized, hedonistic, that's a totally different kind of misconception of the pleasure of being in the world. Okay, it's again, you know, hedonism within civilization is a result of gorging and devouring and misappropriating resources. Again, it's rooted in the concept of resources, and that leads us to some possessing resources and others, again, you know, acting as objects of pleasure. And you have the whole like conception of gender and sexual pleasure, you know, inebriation. It all comes with this civilized need to kind of disengage from empathy and from the world in order to be able to loot it and pollute it and destroy it and use it and just for your own joy. So that's like another. But in the wild, it's just really pleasant to be in the company of that diversity of life. And the landscape could be different. It's a very different pleasure of being in the desert. It's a very different pleasure of being in the ocean, on the mountain, in the forest, in the jungle. Every single corner is so magnificent and so wonderful. And so we don't need a study to tell us that in order for life to be so beautiful and the world to be so beautiful, it has to have certain cooperation standards, certain standards of mutuality, because it's only in parasitic relationships that there is pain. Because if one extracts pleasure only one way without giving back, then the object of that extraction at a certain point is drained out and dies. It can be an individual specimen, or it could be a whole community. It could be a single community. It could be a diverse community. And so in this respect, then, it's to me, every time I see these studies on mice and animals, it's like my heart cringes, because we should not be studying them in these environments. It's like, but at the same time, these observations obviously reveal to the surprised civilized individuals and groups that, oh, well, mice do have this intelligence. Well, obviously they have this intelligence. They've been around longer than us. Grass, I keep saying always, probably is the most intelligent, because that's been, or amoeba in the ocean, have been longer than any mammals. And so they must be the most intelligent, the most empathic, the most giving, and the ones that need the most of our reverence. You know, you look at Isaiah Zhitkalasa in a Native American writer in my book, you know, and how she talks about the meadow, you know, the flowers, those people, those folks of different colors, and the green blades, and how they look. And this is who they are, you know, they are just there for themselves. You don't cut them, you don't pick them, you just tiptoe and marvel.
So if domestication and civilization includes and requires people to be disengaged from the rest of the natural world that we should be existing as a part of and with, and even if you're not utilizing, like having a utilizing like mind frame towards something, well, actually, no, like it means not thinking about things that aren't potentially useful. That thing doesn't exist because it's not potentially useful for me. So I think that like pointing to those studies can be a way of, I mean, it should be a simple thing for us to be able to open our eyes and just observe. But even getting to the point of having our eyes wide enough to be able to see relationships and realize the implications of how the world lives and how we live within it and with each other and with ourselves, I think that it's not a simple step. It is a simple step, but most of us aren't open to taking it, I think.
Yes, I understand. And there's also, for example, for me, because I'm kind of, I don't like the word in between cultures, because I actually did take from different cultures. So Russian culture, Sudanese, British colonial, because that was my schooling, then the US, you know, that's where I did my undergraduate studies, lived for 5 years, traveled extensively, Canada, Sweden, obviously. So these are all the cultures from which, you know, with which I engage and from whom I take what is good and I critique what is not good. And I find, yes, part of civilization is that it always finds a way to create a religion. And so it's very difficult to argue with religious people. And in this kind of religious conception, I include atheists and scientists, because those scientists and those atheists who kind of dogmatically state certain things that are basically they derive their privileges, scientific or atheist privileges, from those statements, it becomes really difficult to argue with them otherwise. So regardless of whether you are a religious Muslim or Christian or atheist, it is really difficult to convince people that humanity and humanism, it not only is not the only conscious group out there in the universe, but could be actually, because of civilization and domestication, lacking intelligence and lagging behind in their possibility to adapt to life, because they have tuned out of that empathic intelligence, of empathic knowledge of how the world lives. And then we come to these studies that, yes, they're useful to illustrate. I mean, it is beautiful what Alexander showed with the rat park, right? But my own kid has made a very similar observation about humans. But to make that step between humans and rats for the civilized is still not, like, very difficult even with a study like this. Because obviously if those studies proved anything to the religious humanists, we would long ago have solved so many of the problems. But obviously we still need to continue to prove that, well, poor people suffer because they are being wronged by society. You still need to convince, you still need to argue, you still need to, and this is the irony, to fund projects, to study. Do poor people really suffer? Do rats really have solidarity or feel pain? Are they conscious? Are they aware of their pain? Well, yeah, maybe they do feel pain, but they're not conscious. They're not aware of their pain. So therefore, it's okay, you know? So, but how about we fund another study? And so this is the irony with these studies. But obviously, anyone who observes animals, it's amazing. Actually, recently there was a study at McGill. I can't remember exactly the name of the professor who did the study, but it's a McGill University study on animals and rats. And that apparently, it was a study on pain. So that's already sadistic, okay? So they were studying how would rats react to pain, or how would pain manifest in rats. And they, after a while, they found that there was something wrong. The rats did not. When the experimenters were present, the rats actually hid. They did not manifest their pain. And then the cameras caught that the minute the people left, they started letting go and kind of letting go there and this, you know, showing that they were actually in pain. So it showed that then there's a gender relationship also, in the sense that, okay, the rats reacted differently in the presence of male experimenters or researchers and female experimenters and researchers. And so, well, you know, then what is the question about rats and, you know, their ability to not demonstrate or to control their pain? It's like you control your tears in public because you're a man, right? You're taught that way, and so this is how you are going to be socialized. What does that tell us about the rat's relationship to the experimenters, their kind of self-awareness, and this horrible reality that you actually need to induce pain in order to observe? That's like, that is sadistic. And so what do we do with this? Like, do we quote the research like that? Do we use it to demonstrate something? Some of the experiments I quote, but others I still cannot go that way, even when I am aware of them.
That makes a lot of sense. Here's a perfect quote. Quote, scientists whisper to each other at conferences that their rodent research subjects appear to be aware of their presence and that this might affect the results of experiments. But this has never been directly demonstrated until now, unquote, says Jeffrey Mogul, a psychology professor at McGill and senior author of the paper.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So what does science teach? You see, and this is my kind of critique of the whole project of education, because it engages both in the production of knowledge and in the transmission of this knowledge. So if the premise itself already starts from civilization, then any knowledge that such a project endorses, I'm not saying that there is no rebellion or resistance within civilization, but this resistance and rebellion is obviously not endorsed and punished severely. Okay, so anything that is endorsed usually goes to prove the very premise, the very basic premise of civilization. And so this is a perfect illustration of that. Still, they are not convinced. Still, they need to be fed in order to carry on more research to check on whether, even though, well, let the mice go and go into the woods and you'll have a much healthier relationship with them, because you will, when the rats or the mice will decide to reveal to you how they live, how they experience joy or pain, then you will be privy to a very special relationship of trust. And if you're not invited, then do you have the right to be a voyeur, a pervert that induces pain in order to observe it, or induces anything in an incarceration environment in order to observe, well, what happens next? And that's the whole premise of that knowledge. And it starts from school, from, you know, with these kids in this diversity project, kindergarten, like, you know, kids' books, education is all rooted in that premise.
You make points of pointing out that the means of domestication through education that is practiced in civilization in the West, in at least like the audience that you're speaking to for the most part when you're publishing this book in English, is about denying empathy, is about denying people's visions of experiencing the world and themselves as a part of it. Can you talk about what education does to humans and how, because people will make the arguments, A, in order for my child to function within society, I need to put them through the system to socialize them so that they can get the tools necessary and function in the way that society requires them to function, which I'm going to present as happy, or like not happy, but healthy at least. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And then because if they don't get that, the alternative is that they are uncontrolled and uncontrollable in a negative sense. Can you talk about like what education does and what children can be like without education?
So the whole project of obligatory education is a new project, right? It's like barely what, like less than 150 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there have been schools and obviously different methods of education before because, well, civilization exists for 10,000 years. So domestication exists for 10,000 years. And domestication as a method of convincing the resources to work exists for 10,000 years. So you start, if you start with crops, well, you know, you just kill everything that is not wanted around you. You label them, you classify anything that is competition as weeds or competition in terms of like human or animal as pests or enemy. And so you have already this categorization based on violence, because in the wilderness, if you do not possess the seeds, then if again, you're privileged to pass by a place and help with the propagation of those plants. You consume the seeds or the fruit. Usually with the fishes, it comes out and, you know, in different places, and you help the reproduction of the wilderness. But the minute you start controlling that environment, so you decide that this place is fertile and you like it because it has your, I don't know, you like raspberries, so all these raspberries are going to be yours. You're going to kill everything else, everyone else, and you're going to plant the whole field full of raspberries. You can't possibly eat them, so you start designing an infrastructure of how you're going to exchange, who's going to guard it for you, who's going to toil. So you need labor, you need, you know, resources for murder of the unwanted competition. This whole socio-environmental and socio-economic infrastructure to build. And with that, you need to convince those resources, the horses, to work. So the horses will not be able to feed themselves and their children. They have to earn it. And they have to earn it by yielding much more surplus to you, so that you would give them what's necessary just to survive, so as they could continue laboring. So you domesticate them through food. How do you domesticate humans? Same way, exactly. But with humans, then what helps is also you have language, and then you can start not always rewarding with food. You can reward with symbolic culture. And so it becomes more elaborate and actually in a different way cruel. With animals, it's really cruel, but with humans, it's more complex, the cruelty, because then through symbolic participation, you can actually induce, educate your resources to want to participate. And so there are different ways of doing it. Now that we have this mega population, this epidemic, obviously, those old ways of domestication and punishment and reward wouldn't work in this macro society. So you invent schools, obligatory schools, where kids would be domesticated into receiving survival tools within this socioeconomic structure. which is based on the extermination of anything that is deemed as competition as useless. Okay? And so the epidemic of all this, all the violence of, recently, I just saw the news, a 16-year-old kid who was a gymnast was shot, Mexican, I think, Hispanic descent.
Yeah, in Oregon State.
Exactly. All these, the spikes in London, okay? This is
and for anyone who might not know what that is, the installation of small spikes on areas of ground that wouldn't stop from someone from like transiting over them, but would make it impossible for someone to be able to sleep in a doorway or what have you, right? That's what you're referring to?
Exactly. So the reaction of the activists who went and covered those spikes with cement is referred to even in the sympathetic media as acts of vandalism. Because the whole knowledge, the whole education system that constructs that knowledge and continues to transmit these attitudes is that the homeless do not belong there. The homeless do not have the right there. So even though it's cruel and there's public outrage, so-called public, if the middle class doesn't have an outrage, then nobody notices. The homeless have an outrage, that's like not public. Right, but now that everybody notices and everybody's writing about it, there's an outrage. Well, this is like going too far, and come on, build them more shelters. Okay, the question that is not being raised is because we are being educated and schooled to survive within the system is that the spikes themselves are the ultimate act of vandalism, not only for the human homeless, but for the life, for the wildlife that should be able to live in any spot on the earth and is being pushed out from these humanist, cleansed for human use streets and spaces and cities. Okay? And so the question of schooling is always about yes, this is exactly the question I have in my book. It's that because, people obviously voice it. Well, how do you want my kid to get a job? How do you want my kid to earn the skills? And it's like, what kind of skills are you talking about? Yes, in order to survive in this civilization, in order for the kid not to so-called suffer because they would yearn for contact with life. They would yearn for the wild spaces. And be content working in the mines in the Congo or in a shopping mall in the States or in Canada or wherever. For them to kind of not be discontent and do as they're told and not risk their lives because they're going to go and put cement over the spikes for the homeless. You educate them in those schools to obey. And you educate, you have a whole curriculum that would show them pictures like that diversity project, that things that the little farm exists for you to get milk, for you to get bread, for you to get whatever. It's for you. And for you, in order to get that, you are like that horse that was domesticated 10,000 years ago. You are going to do some work because you don't have the right to eat unless you are a resource who has yielded more in terms of surplus energy and product to be able to consume a little bit of that bread, a little bit of that cheese, okay? And a little bit of that pork. That cute little pig that you saw is your dish, it's pork. The children's story, the three little pigs, that's like totally a carnivorous nightmare for kids because you first identify with those animals as wanting to live and wanting to build. You anthropomorphize them, but then in the morning you give them a sandwich to school and there's your ham. And this is what school teaches you, that it's okay for you to associate a little bit at having a bedtime story read to you about three little pigs, but in the morning this is your sandwich in the end. That's normal. Don't fight, don't resist, go to the mall, go to your job, produce, and then maybe you can eat. And if you want your kids to have a larger understanding and give them a choice to whether resist or whether to have a dream to build a community that is satisfying in its diversity and in its possibilities, you are going to integrate them in life. And schools do not integrate them in life. They integrate them in a system that isolates them from life and gives them these methodologies of how to control and suppress life that is not wanted and breed the life that is useful to some. And you are a part of it. And so basically this would be my long response, and it's shorter in the book.
The story of peoples who lived in lands with elephants, like taking young elephants from their families and from their herds and staking them with a stick and a rope to a point in the ground. And then as the elephant, and this is a very sad story, but as the elephant grew up, it would consider its limitations of its possibility of traveling limited to its relationship of string or of like rope to that stake. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that seems kind of an apt metaphor. If I could have remembered the story a little bit better and explained it better, but kind of an apt metaphor for what education does to the child, kind of stunts growth and ability to be flexible.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, and it applies to all, like, you know, chained dogs or, any animal or pet. And humans, when they were slaves, they were chained as well. And it totally applies to the set, in the sense that if you're incarcerated in a building, then obviously you will not be aware of the possibility, you will not have the skill to venture. It's going to be dangerous because you know you'll be punished. You know, truancy is punished. Recently, you know, this tragic, tragic story of the mother who died because she had this huge fine from her kid's truancy to, I think, couple of $1,000, mm-hmm. And so they jailed her. I mean, this is your ultimate kind of articulation of how deadly the punishment for resisting civilized education and domestication is, in that a poor mother is punished and kids are usually prosecuted. Like, you know, there's an incredible statistic, especially in the States where kids, police come intervene in acts of truancy because the kids rebel against that system of incarceration. And sometimes some of them actually spend times in the library. We had here an incident in Montreal. Okay, the library knows that my kid was homeschooled, so she would go to the library during school days and, you know, just like talk to the librarians, ask for books, read, you know, if there's a workshop, she'll attend it. But then the librarian, with tears in her eyes, had to call the parents of a kid who actually would skip school. And she was like, he's such a good kid, and I really hate doing it, but we were ordered that if he skips school and comes to the library, we call his parents because the school needs to know, and he would be, and he needs to be punished. And she hated doing it, but she still did it. Well, I wouldn't have, but she would call. And the kid stopped coming to the library. I have no idea where he started skipping. But, you know, it's one of those methods of controlling and tying you to a closed space from which it is dangerous to leave. Because what you need to learn is how to function in the future to get a job and be a resource. With animals, it's obviously like much, much more brutal because there's a lot of real pain involved and real massacres.
You make a very clear and strong arguments against domestication in regards to animal agency, rape culture, among human animals, policies concerning reproductive freedom, social hierarchies and disability, among other things. Can we explore maybe like this? Because in terms of like utilization and usefulness, and you talk about domestication and civilization and how gender plays out in that.
Okay. Well, yes, because the whole construction of gender started with the very concept of domestication. Because if we're talking about if you're talking about non-living resources, well, it's just basically you're concerned with property rights and a way to protect those rights, right? If you're concerned with living resources, then if the living resources die and refuse to reproduce, then basically you can use them for this period of time and that's it. And this is where, again, reproduction, education, gender, and violence come in as really like intrinsic part of civilization and domestication, without which civilization wouldn't have had a chance to survive. And that is then you identify who is going to reproduce the resources, the physical bodies, and who is going to reproduce the indoctrination or the epistemology by which those resources are going to function within that hierarchical system of ownership and resource or work, right? Or labor.
And that could be kind of compared to like sorting seeds or like some of the practices of breeding ducks together to get this certain kind of duck, right? Like forcing them to not have the ability to choose wildly and freely in a way that would probably better strengthen their offspring, be healthier, because it wouldn't be a forced thing. But
absolutely. The word healthier is the problem because, yeah, healthier in the sense that mutated enough to survive the insane side effects and horrors and illness of civilization, because obviously the strain of reproduction, because then you need to maximize the resource production, right? So you are going to force the females to produce who you want and how many you want. So that becomes their labor class. This is the femaleness now exists as a category for the production of your resources. It becomes a class, a labor class that is laboring, quite literally, in every sense, like in several, like all the puns intended. And so it applies both to human and to non-human resources. But then also with patriarchy, because then if the woman is the one who controls the reproduction of resources, she can have, she could have a say and rebel or resist, right? But if you disempower, if you have the epistemology that institutionalizes a patriarchal and patrilineal transmission of power and capital, material and social capital, then you have it all set. Because for the woman to participate in this system of lack of distribution of resources and capital, the only way is to produce and to agree to produce more. Because and this is how all these patriarchal civilizations, by their nature, are patriarchal. And this is how they have come about and how they function. You reward the woman only in that, to that extent that she reproduces. And so the men then decide who marries whom, how the wealth goes down. And it's the same with the animals. Like you, the farmer, the engineer, the genetic engineer decides, and it's usually male, it's not a coincidence, decides who you're going to mate, how you're going to mate. And then you are going to use all the unwanted males for meat or labor, and the females, say, for example, I use the example of turkeys or cows in my book, you use them for reproduction and milk, and how do you then go about insemination? That's rape. And so this is the very, it's like to your face, but in symbolic culture, you can call it something else. You can call it insemination. You can call it husbandry. So it doesn't appear violent. You are going to identify only human animals as being capable of experiencing rape, and still in specific circumstances, because not every rape is equal in civilization. And we see how all these courts handle cases of rape in the States, in India, anywhere in the world. A woman could be raped, and sometimes it is decided that it is a case of rape, and sometimes not, because the narrative of civilization sees it as normal. This is the basis of civilized relationships that we are not aware of. And only when we start looking at it from the perspective of wilderness, that if women, and in wilderness, there isn't even that category, it's an anthropological category of womanhood, even when it applies to turkey women or bovine women, right? It's still an anthropological construct in the sense that it stems from our identification of humanity and agency, who has the right to reproduce and who has the right to force or improve reproduction. This is how it's referred to. And so if it is seen as improving the reproduction, then it's not rape. And this is the narrative that kids tune into really early in school, like in kindergarten. They already are getting in that kind of macho culture, and the girls are geared towards their future reproductive services, you know, at that stage. And the incredibly tragic, but at the same time, kind of normal development of civilization, the cases of rape and the harassment that comes with it, and the lack of desire of the courts to do anything about it, should reveal to the people that, well, because the concepts of justice are based on normalizing and naturalizing such relationships, these will not be persecuted. Even here in Canada, I know in the States, Canada has this reputation of being the more just and more kind of the softer nation. But in cases of rape, in the eastern provinces, a couple of years ago, a young woman was raped. It was recorded, it was YouTubed, and she was harassed, persecuted. Nothing was done to the rapist, even though everybody knew, and she committed suicide. It's only one example of so many others. And it's been time, like, well, 10,000 years ago, this should have been contained, but okay, well, we've been through 10,000 years of civilization. Isn't it time for people to look at the situation and say, well, obviously it hasn't worked, the system of justice?
Let's see. So here's a narrative. There's an assumption that's taught to children through education and the passed on from parents and everything as to why the way that we live is the best way to live, and why so many other people are attempting to, in our mindset, are attempting to adopt our means of living in relation to the world in terms of civilization and our domestication of animals and the hierarchies that we've built, that it's necessary for, it's a manifest destiny story almost, that people developed communities and hierarchies and privatized the land and imprisoned people and declared war on other peoples because basically we were able to, and therefore that right is there. People were conquered because their communities were weaker. And we settled and started agriculture because it made us healthier. And with that health and vigorousness, we began expanding our reproduction just through that vigor. and taking over other areas. Like, this is the narrative that we're taught in Western civilization, is that manifest our mm-hmm. strengths and our goodness and our quote-unquote health is manifest in the fact that the society with which we participate and whose values we have inculcated dominates.
Yes, absolutely. And for that narrative to work, the very first step that civilization took was to establish this, to naturalize human predation, to focus on predators and to say that, okay, because there are predators and predators are the successful, like you start attributing success and failure to different modes of relating, but taken out of their context. Because obviously in wilderness, billions of the majority of species on Earth were not predators. Had they been predators, obviously they would have devoured everything, just like we did, right? So the predators were always the minority. They reproduced less, they slept more, they ate much less. And this is their digestive systems are very different, and their social relations are very different, precisely in order to continue to be in the minority, in order to just not to take over, right? And so the non-predators flourished, and primates like us flourished. And for the most part, well, most primates are actually almost 100% frugivores and herbivores. They eat fruits and veggies and greens, with the exception of very few that would consume some proteins, and usually it's ants or worms or insects. And with one group in a species of these apes, that some of them, and only one group of that group, called now Homo sapiens, the wise ape, which is also...
yeah, of course we named ourselves.
Exactly. It's a joke in itself. And so they came up with the idea that we should, that scavenging should become hunting. And with hunting, the representation and the normalization of that mode of life, which was still, mind you, just like with the chimps, less than 10% of their diet is protein, insect or small animal, and small animal only when human-induced the desertification started occurring due to farming and cities, expansion of cities. But humans originally did not consume that much, maybe scavenging a little bit when they seemed to be some catastrophes. But when hunting started happening and symbolic language and symbolic culture started emerging, to me that is not a coincidence. It seems that at a certain point, some groups started favoring that culture of subsistence. And with that, then, in a way, with the first murder, and actually I talk about that, I have a play called Red Delicious, interpretation of our monotheistic narrative and science, the intersections with science and academia and civilization, and how the first murder could have been the birth of impatience, which is time, and so our separation from the earth, from a holistic conception of all these dimensions of space and time, into regulated time that is separate from the regulated space, which you control and abuse. And this this predatory narrative is the one then that is responsible for the ability of that group to devise a totally new culture, which is intrinsically, inherently colonizing and expansionist. And so with that expansion, and it starts with the fact that if you are going to hunt, you need a point to where the hunters would return. So maybe a beginning of sedentarism needed to be starting right there, with women collecting most of the food sources from the area, and women wanting to economize their effort because now they needed to have the surplus, because hunting is not economically viable, because you need to spend much more energy hunting a living being than what you can yield. You can, like, a hunter cannot feed the family. It's like one adventure, you bring it, you eat it. You need a predatory digestive system. But to go back to the beginning of civilization, agriculture, when you start possessing the land and needing all these resources and energy in order to dominate it and protect it from invaders, there's incredible toll on health. More people are needed in one specific space that are need to be exploited with constant borrowing of energy from other sources, that and the crowded conditions and the malnourishment and the overwork kind of grows as civilization advances. And so the health, the paleontological findings show that is when the health, especially of women and children, started giving in, and civilized agricultural women, children, and the elderly started dying off much earlier. Now have findings of Neanderthal bones that show that they could live even without teeth until old age, because the community helped each other and they never had a settlement with exploitation. You know, there was mutual cooperation and mutual aid. But with agricultural civilizations and cities and settlements, it became one-way hierarchical drawing of energy from the bottom to the top. And so those who were at the top would obviously maybe have better lives because they had all the other working on their behalf. But the lower you go down the hierarchy, the larger the base of the hierarchy of the exploited, okay? That usually with the animals and women of color at the bottom. And that's when you have all the suffering and early mortality, which has never gone away. It's the same today. Like, you trace that decrease in health and longevity, it is still here today. And we compare statistics of one and the same city, poor neighborhood, rich neighborhood, sometimes 10 years, sometimes up to 28 years of difference in longevity within the same city between the rich and the poor. And so the myth of that health and improvement is a myth that is generated obviously from those who have experienced that improvement, or they claim it to be improvement. Actually, they probably would have enjoyed a much better life in the wilderness along with everyone else. But since they are at the top and they don't see the bottom and they have forgotten what it's like to go out in the wilderness, and their symbolic capital and wealth makes it easy for them to buy off life of the others, animal and non-human animals, then it's easy to kind of come up with that myth and spread it around. Well, look, if you work hard enough, you'll be like us. The statistics show us it's not true. Most poor people are either killed or die from diseases, from depression, from suicide, from whatever. It is not true.
It's like promising the horizon to someone.
Yes.
Thank you so much for this conversation. Really enjoyed it. I'd like to chat some other time.
Absolutely, Burst.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP out of Columbus, Ohio.